And now it's time for the Earth First Update. All the environmental news you can use for the 9th of April, 2015. My name is Uncle Dennis. We're in the studios of Free Radio Santa Cruz. And I want to invite you to pick up a pencil and paper and have it handy, because you never know when something you hear on the Earth First Update could be useful. Web pages, addresses, times, locations, things like that. Maybe you want to make sure you know what they are. Of course, you can listen later, but if you write it down the first time, you'll have it. Like, coming up in a couple of days here in Santa Cruz is the State of the San Lorenzo River Symposium. That's this Saturday, April 11th, from 9 a.m. to 5 p.m. It's a day of presentations and discussions about the health of our river, the San Lorenzo River. The event will be held at the Santa Cruz Civic Auditoriums, hosted by the City of Santa Cruz, the Coastal Watershed Council, and the Santa Cruz Fish and Game Commission. The discussion will be primarily focused on fisheries and water quality issues, though future similar events will delve into other important watershed issues. Breakfast and snacks will be provided, but please bring your own lunch if you're going to join us for the whole day. Keynote speaker John Laird, the Secretary of Natural Resources for the State of California, and other guest speakers include Fred Keeley and Rosemary Menard. If you want more information, go to www.coastal-watershed.org. That's www.coastal-watershed.org. And once again, the State of the San Lorenzo River Symposium this Saturday, April 11th, from 9 a.m. to 5 p.m. at the Santa Cruz Civic Auditorium, corner of Church and whatever it is, Center Street? Yeah, something like that. And in the follow-up to the news that the Sea Shepherd Conservation Society has been giving us for many weeks on their Operation Icefish, this is the end of it. The Sea Shepherd Conservation Society reports that the notorious poaching vessel Thunder sank inside the exclusive economic zone of Sao Tome on the 6th of April, 2015, off the coast of West Africa. The Sea Shepherd ships Bob Barker and Sam Simon are in the process of rescuing the entire crew of 40 people, including the captain, officers, and deck crew, who are all able to disembark into life rafts from the Thunder before it sank. The captain of the Bob Barker, Peter Hammerstedt, said, "When my chief engineer boarded the Thunder in the hours leading up to the sinking, he was able to confirm that there were clear signs that the vessel was intentionally scuttled. Usually, when a vessel is sinking, the captain will close all hatches so as to maintain buoyancy. However, on the Thunder, the reverse was done. All doors and hatches were tied open, and the fish hold was open. It is an incredibly suspicious situation, to say the least." Sea Shepherd has been able to confirm that there were no reported injuries. The crew of the Thunder have been supplied with food and water, and have been taken aboard the San Simon, and the latest news is that they were put ashore in Ghana, West Africa. The captain of the Sam Simon, Sid Chakravarti, said, "With the safety of my own crew also in mind, we will now take every precaution to ensure that the crew of the Thunder is retrieved from the lifeboat safely." The Thunder was the most notorious of six vessels, which Sea Shepherd called the Bandit Six, that are known to engage in illegal, unreported, and unregulated fishing of vulnerable toothfish in the Southern Ocean. The Bob Barker was engaged in a four-month record-breaking pursuit of the vessel, which has gone from the Southern to the Indian to the Atlantic Oceans. On December 25th, the Sam Simon commenced retrieval operations to remove illegal fishing gear abandoned by the Thunder when it first fled from the Bob Barker. More than 72 kilometers, that's about 50 miles, of illegal gill net was recovered over a three-week period, and over 1,400 fish weighing a total of 45,000 kilograms, that's about 100,000 pounds of fish, were returned to the ocean. On February 25th, the San Simon handed over the confiscating fishing gear as evidence of the Thunder's illegal fishing activities to authorities in Mauritius. In March, another two of the Bandit Six, the Viking and the Kunlun, were detained by authorities in Southeast Asia. The captains of both those vessels were arrested for fisheries-related crimes. And just as we reported last week, Nigeria revoked the certificate of the Thunder, and it became a stateless vessel, which probably led to it being sunk 2 days ago. All these poaching vessels were the target of Sea Shepherd's 11th Southern Ocean Defense Campaign, Operation Icefish, which is now over. If you want more information, go to www.seashepherd.org.au. That's www.seashepherd.org.au. And I might say that thanks to all the people involved, Peter Hammerstedt and Sid Chakravarti, the captain of both vessels, and I know there were many, many, many Sea Shepherd volunteers on board throughout that entire operation. And they deserve your thanks as well as your support. Here's the Buffalo Field Campaign's update from the field. They report hazing madness. The hazing and harassment has begun again this year near West Yellowstone, Montana. Although no cattle will be in the ecosystem until mid-June at the earliest, daily harassment has become the standard of operations. These abusive events occur on national forest land, public land where cattle will never be. Please call and email Montana State Veterinarian Marty Zalewski. His number 406-444-2043. Once again, that name, Marty Zalewski, Montana State Veterinarian. The number 406-444-2043. His email is mzalewski, M-Z-A-L-U-S-K-I at mt.gov. And please call and email Governor of Montana, Governor Bullock. His number 406-444-3111. Now, once again, that number 406-444-3111 for Governor Bullock of Montana. And you can also email him at governor@mt.gov and tell them to end the abuse of America's last wild buffalo. It's been a hazing frenzy this past week, and buffalo are showing growing resistance to this abuse. Much earlier in the season than we typically see this behavior, the buffalo are making it clear that this is going to be a difficult season for the Montana Department of Livestock and their cooperating agencies. During patrols this past week, we have already seen the Montana Department of Livestock, Montana Fish, Wildlife, and Parks give up on two hazing operations along the Medicine Arm Road of Gallatin National Forest. Two herds they were attempting to haze were deemed uncooperative. Can you believe that? Uncooperative buffalo. In one case, a radio-collared female bolted off of the road, going about a half a mile through thick, deadfall timber. Shortly after, the rest of her herd followed her while the agents were trying to figure out what to do because the fallen trees were too thick to take their horses through. While the herd met up with the lone female, two Montana Department of Livestock agents struggled for half an hour trying to move the herd back to the road. To our delight, they ended up quitting and rode back to the road empty-handed. On subsequent hazing operations, more agents had been called in to assist with these anti-buffalo operations, and they've already begun resorting to firing cracker rounds, explosive launched from shotguns, to scare the buffalo and almost everything else in the landscape, as well as bull whips, and the obnoxious sounds they are making are becoming louder and more frequent. The buffalo are tired of being bullied around, and they are showing strong resistance. Bluff charges have come early and often this season, and in one haze in the span of less than half an hour, we witnessed one agent being bluff charged 8 times. Many of the buffalo that get hazed return to their original location only days later, and then the agents come back and repeat the same redundant process over and over and over. The agent's response to the buffalo's resistance has unfortunately been to haze them from areas where they are allowed to be, so-called tolerance zones, in attempts to push them all to Horse Butte, where they will descend upon them with a militaristic hazing in mid to late May. All of the areas the buffalo are being hazed from are cattle-free, meaning there is no conflict and absolutely no reason for the hazing. Except for some small parcels of private land, some even buffalo-friendly, wild bison are being chased off of our public lands that will never host any invasive livestock. The Montana Department of Livestock is being unnecessarily aggressive to make their wretched jobs more convenient, and the Montana State Veterinarian Marty Zalewski holds all the power, so the Montana Department of Livestock can basically do whatever they want. In addition to hazing, buffalo are having to navigate the perils of U.S. Highway 191, a busy stretch of road that cuts right through their migration corridor. I've been personally on that road myself, and I know that, man, oh, man, you come along a buffalo there, and could be a real problem. Early Wednesday morning, a semi-truck hit and killed a pregnant buffalo beside the Madison River on a migration route heavily used by hundreds of buffalo. Even with our warning signs and the many other traffic signs in place, buffalo are still victims to those who choose to ignore the warnings. We desperately need safe passage infrastructure here, which would allow wildlife to cross the road without ever having to set foot on it. The Buffalo Field Campaign has been working night and day, chasing after agents who are chasing after the buffalo, documenting all the actions against them, and spending countless hours along the highway, trying to best ensure that buffalo can safely migrate to their calving grounds. If you have ever considered volunteering with the Buffalo Field Campaign on the front lines, we could certainly use your help right now. Please go to their webpage, www.buffalofieldcampaign.org. Check out how to volunteer. Make sure you understand what it's about, and then email Mike and all the rest of the crew and tell them you're coming. Once again, that webpage, www.buffalofieldcampaign.org. They also have lists of equipment that they need, and they always need money. Send it to the Buffalo Field Campaign, P.O. Box 957, West Yellowstone, Montana, the zip code 59758. If you have any questions, give the crew a call at 406-646-0070. Once again, the Buffalo Field Campaign, P.O. Box 957, West Yellowstone, Montana, 59758. And the phone number, 406-646-0070. Or you can always go to www.buffalofieldcampaign.org, and all that information and more is there. Do remember that the Buffalo Field Campaign is the only group working in the field every day in defense of the last wild buffalo in the United States. And moving to more local news over across the bay and on the east side of the San Francisco Bay, groups blast Caltrans's construction plans for Niles Canyon in this story written by Jeff Miller, a really great longtime activist over there with the Alameda Creek Alliance. Local groups are opposing Caltrans's proposal for the Alameda Creek Bridge replacement project in Niles Canyon, exposing it as an overbuilt highway widening project that would increase driving speeds through the canyon and could actually reduce safety for motorists and bicyclists while cutting down 300 to 400 native trees and damaging wildlife habitat along Alameda Creek. The Alameda Creek Alliance, numerous groups, and experts submitted more than 50 pages of critical comments last week on the draft environmental impact report for the project. Quote, this Caltrans project is anything but a simple bridge replacement. It involves widening up to half a mile of Niles Canyon Road, removing hundreds of native trees, and excavating along thousands of feet of the canyon, adding large retaining walls, said Jeff Miller, director of the Alameda Creek Alliance. Again, quoting, Caltrans' overbuilt approach is simply not needed to make the bridge segment safer. Caltrans claims the project to replace the 87-year-old Alameda Creek Bridge and add modern safety railings and road shoulders on the bridge is needed for bicyclists and motorists' safety. Caltrans proposes engineering the new bridge and its roadway approaches to increase motorist speeds from 35 to 45 miles an hour, while widening the entire roadway through the half-mile project to reach 42 feet with shoulders. The project would require realigning 1,400 feet of roadway for the western approach and 300 to 1,190 feet for the eastern approach. Construction would damage significant areas of the canyon with hundreds of thousands of feet of cut and fill and large concrete retaining walls, both above the roadway and adjacent to Alameda Creek. It would also require cutting from 284 to 414 native trees and encroaching on habitat for the threatened Alameda whipsnakes, steelhead trout, and red-legged frogs. Quoting again, Caltrans has proposed a clean slate on the Niles Canyon Highway project with consideration of public input, but this project is more of the same, trying to turn Niles Canyon Road into a freeway one segment at a time, said Miller. Again, quoting, Caltrans should look at the alternatives that would replace the bridge at the current speed of 35 miles an hour, which would scale back the need for tree cutting and other severe environmental impacts. And here's the background to this story. Caltrans claims the agency is required to increase the design speed of the bridge and its approaches to the posted speed limit of 45 miles an hour. Yet many locations throughout the canyon are posted for 30 to 35 miles an hour because of tight turns in the narrow canyon. The Federal Highway Administration and Caltrans' own highway design manual allow a lower than standard design speed based on environmental safety and other considerations. The four alternatives analyzed by Caltrans in the Environmental Impact Report for the bridge replacement project all increase the design speed, contain the same increases in turn radius for the bridge approaches, and only differ in how much cut and fill and retaining walls would be constructed on the east and west approaches to the bridge. All of the Caltrans alternatives would have severe impacts on riparian trees, endangered species habitat, and the hydrology and habitat value of Alameda Creek. Caltrans did not evaluate whether the 2007 project that installed centerline rubble strips through Niles Canyon had reduced vehicle collisions in the project area. Caltrans acknowledges that it has not even begun mitigation for its abandoned highway widening project in Lower Niles Canyon in 2011, when the agency cut 150 native trees along Alameda Creek. Caltrans has several other planned safety projects in the Niles Canyon corridor that will cumulatively cut or impact a total of 550 to 650 native trees. Caltrans has no timeline for mitigation of tree cutting impacts from the bridge replacement project and no details about where mitigation tree planting will occur. Caltrans has acknowledged that it cannot find suitable nearby mitigation areas that are acceptable to regulatory agencies, nor can it adequately mitigate for cutting large mature trees and the loss of habitat values they provide for native wildlife. The proposed bridge replacement project does contain some environmentally beneficial elements, including removal of a concrete weir in Alameda Creek, which currently serves as a barrier to fish passage, removing the bridge's existing in-stream piers, and removal of invasive plants. A dozen community groups have proposed safety solutions for Niles Canyon Road that do not involve the needless destruction of the environmental and scenic values of Alameda Creek or Niles Canyon, and have opposed Caltrans' plans to increase the design speed of the Alameda Creek Bridge and other road segments. Caltrans initially proposed a three-phase highway safety project that involved widening much of Niles Canyon Road between Fremont and Interstate 680, which would damage habitat for steelhead trout and other endangered species, remove rare sycamore forests along the creek. Caltrans internally approved phase one of the project in 2006 without alerting a single member of the public. Caltrans cut nearly 100 trees in the canyon in the spring of 2011. After large public protests, the Alameda Creek Alliance filed a suit challenging the inadequate environmental review. A court order in June of 2011 halted construction, and a settlement agreement in December forced Caltrans to abandon the project. In 2012, the Federal Highway Administration conducted a road safety assessment of Niles Canyon, finding that Caltrans' proposed highway widening was not warranted by the safety data. The Federal Highway Administration's four other locations in the canyon with higher priority needed safety improvements than the Alameda Creek Bridge. And for more information, go to www.alamedacreek.org. That's www.alamedacreek.org. And the California Fish and Wildlife Service doesn't care about the Humboldt Martin in this story by Rob DiPerna of the Environmental Protection Information Center. The Fish and Wildlife Service issued their 12-month finding on the Humboldt Martin listing petition submitted by the Environmental Protection Information Center and the Center for Biological Diversity. While the service acknowledged that the populations of coastal martins are extremely small and isolated, the service did not find the martin threatened or endangered. This conclusion is dubious and runs counter to the best available science. The Humboldt Martin is a stealthy, cat-sized forest carnivore in the weasel family and related to minks and otters. The Humboldt Martin is so rare that it was thought to be extinct until rediscovered in 1996. These extremely secretive animals are known for their slinky walking motion and ability to prey on porcupines by biting them in the face. Typically about 2 feet long with large triangular ears and a long tail, they eat small mammals, berries, and birds, but are preyed on by larger mammals and raptors. Due to extensive clear-cut logging and short-rotation forestry on low-lying coastal forests on private lands, which have replaced the diverse native forests of Northern California and Southern Oregon with oversimplified tree plantations, the marten has been eliminated from 95% of its historic range. In order to save this unique carnivore from oblivion, the Environmental Protection Information Center petitioned the Fish and Wildlife Service to list the Humboldt marten under the Endangered Species Act. The recent decision is a blow to marten conservation in Northern California. "I'm shocked and disappointed," said Tom Wheeler, program and legal coordinator at EPIC. The Fish and Wildlife Service admits that the California marten population only totals around 40 individuals. The service has no idea how many coastal martens are left in Oregon, but all experts agree that the population there isn't thriving either. "Our martens are holding on by a thread, but the service has its head in the sand." Rob DiPerna, California Forest and Wildlife Advocate at EPIC, concurred, "The service's decision was not based on the best available science. The decision discounts the numerous serious threats to the marten while trumpeting voluntary conservation measures as a fix to the marten's problems. Under the Fish and Wildlife Service's rationale, the marten won't recover and may go extinct in the near future." Despite the current setback, the Environmental Protection Information and the Center for Biological Diversity will continue to work on as necessary and immediate protections for the Humboldt marten. While the Fish and Wildlife Service may not care about the marten, EPIC does. And for more information, go to their website, www.wildcalifornia.org. That's www.wildcalifornia.org. And Cascadia challenges Wildlife Services in Washington. The Western Environmental Law Center, on behalf of five conservation groups, has filed a lawsuit against the U.S. Department of Agriculture's Wildlife Services program, challenging its authority to kill endangered wolves in Washington state. The National Environmental Policy Act requires the USDA to prepare an in-depth environmental impact statement addressing the effects of employing Wildlife Services to kill endangered wolves in Washington. The agency completed a less detailed environmental assessment, but the document contains significant gaps and does not address specific issues that will significantly impact wolves and the human environment. NEPA review is designed to ensure all environmental impacts are analyzed and that the public has an opportunity to comment and therefore influence activities conducted using public funds. The environmental assessment prepared by Wildlife Services fails to provide data to support several of its core assertions. For example, Wildlife Services claims that killing wolves reduces wolf-caused losses of livestock, yet recent peer-reviewed research in the Washington State University directly contradicts this conclusion, finding that killing wolves actually leads to an increase in wolf-livestock conflicts. The environmental assessment also fails to address the ecological effects of killing wolves in Washington, including impacts on wolf populations in neighboring states and on non-target animals, including federally protected grizzly bears and Canada lynx. Wildlife Services activities related to wolves in Washington have been extremely harmful, said John Melgren, attorney at the Western Environmental Law Center. "The science tells us that killing wolves does not actually reduce wolf-livestock conflicts, but Wildlife Services is continuing its brutal assault on this iconic animal, and it needs to stop." Wildlife Services is a standalone federal extermination program under USDA that kills roughly 4 million animals per year, including wolves, grizzly bears, otters, foxes, coyotes, and birds, with almost no oversight or accountability. A 2013 internal audit revealed that Wildlife Services' accounting practices lacked transparency and violated state and federal laws. Concerns about the program's practices and effectiveness are the focus of an ongoing investigation by the U.S. Department of Agriculture's Inspector General. Wildlife Services has a horrendous track record of animal abuse, missing funds, poor or non-existent policy, and misinformation that has inflamed rural areas throughout the Pacific Northwest, said Nick Cady, legal director at Cascadia Wildlands. "This program has no place in Washington, where the people have tasked the state agencies to facilitate wolf recovery and conservation." Washington has experienced Wildlife Services' recklessness firsthand. Last August, Wildlife Services snipers mistakenly shot and killed the Huckleberry Wolf Pack's alpha female during a helicopter gunning operation. The killing was in direct violation of explicit instructions from the Washington Department of Fish and Wildlife not to kill either of the pack's alpha members. The death of the Huckleberry Pack's breeding female threatens the future of the entire pack. Let's put this issue of wolf management into the proper context, said Timothy Coleman, executive director of Kettle Range Conservation Group. There are just 3 breeding female wolves in all of Washington, so why is the federal government's wildlife services and their sharpshooting snipers in Washington killing and trapping wolves? Certainly, the public should have more say when such decisions are made. Wildlife Services also advised Washington Department of Fish and Wildlife in the contentious 2012 killing of Washington's wedge wolf pack. In that instance, Washington Department of Fish and Wildlife killed 7 wolves after depredations of livestock on public lands despite the rancher's failure to take sufficient action to protect his cattle. Wildlife Services' refusal to ensure its activities are based on the best available science strips the public of an opportunity to meaningfully understand and contribute to decisions impacting the health of ecosystems on which we all depend, said Bethany Cotton, Wildlife Program Director at Wild Earth Guardians. It's past time that the dark practices of Wildlife Services are subjected to the sunshine of a transparent public process. And you can find more information at www.cascwild.org. That's cascwild.org. And in a victory, a ruling protects whales and dolphins from the Navy's war games. Whales, dolphins, and other marine mammals in the Pacific just caught an important break. A Hawaii District Court judge has ruled that the National Marine Fisheries Service wrongly approved U.S. Navy testing and training activities that pose serious harm to sea animals. The Navy's use of explosives and sonar along with vessel strikes could result in thousands of animals suffering death or injuries over a 5-year period, potentially causing an estimated 9.6 million instances of harm. The decision results from a December 2013 lawsuit brought by a coalition including the Center for Biological Diversity. Noting the stunning number of marine mammals the Navy's activities could hurt, the judge said, searching the administrative records reams of pages for some explanation as to why the Navy's activities were authorized, this court feels like the sailor in Samuel Taylor Coleridge's Rime of the Ancient Mariner, who trapped for days on a ship becalmed in the middle of the ocean, laments, "Water, water everywhere, nor any drop to drink." The Navy shouldn't play war games in the most sensitive waters animal use for breeding and feeding, said Miyoko Sakashita, the Center for Biological Diversity's Oceans Director. And unfortunately, that's all the time we have for the Earth First Update this week. The Earth First Update is presented every Thursday evening at 9 o'clock here on Free Radio Santa Cruz. And you can listen to a rebroadcast tomorrow afternoon at 3 o'clock right here on Free Radio Santa Cruz 101.3. On Mondays, if you live in Moscow, Idaho, you can listen to 90.3 KRFP Radio Free Moscow at 9:30 p.m. Or you can go to radioforall.net where you can listen online anytime or download this or previous editions of the Earth First Update. And I have some news from Radio Free Edmonton. They have gone back and recreated themselves. They are now northbysouthradio.com. That is northbysouthradio.com. And they are going to be offering a pop-up radio service, unfortunately without a schedule, but the Earth First Update will be in there somewhere. The Earth First Update is a production of Earth First Radio and is produced in the studios of Free Radio Santa Cruz. I want to thank you for listening, and do tune in next Thursday evening for another edition of the Earth First Update.